voting against you getting in those organizations, you out. I mean, you couldn't get in. You could not out, but you couldn't get in. So you, these were on all the campuses. Mm-hmm. And the good-looking women were supposed to have been dominating one sorority. That could be in Ithaca, New York. They could the good-looking women could dominate a fraternity in Chicago, but they you go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, in the college down there, could be just the opposite. So locale meant a great deal.
Sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, I told my son when you went back, I said, I know you can. It's easy to say. You're not too much interested in sororities and so forth. I said, that's fine. I said, but I want you to know it can save you many a dollar if you are interested, if you travel a lot. See? Now, do you catch how it helps?
Because you can stay with somebody in the same...
I can hit any town in this country where there's a university, and I can go and find out who is the alpha man, who is in charge, and all I need to do is contact him and walk up and give him a grip, and this gets you, it saves you from going through the ordeal of picking your friends. They're already there. You know if he's an alpha man, he's okay. At least he was okay when he was in school with everybody, and he didn't get a blackball. See?
Uh-huh.
Now, it's regarded as snobbish, but with a guy, you ask a guy if he went to certain universities and so forth. Yeah, where'd schools go to? I went to the University of Chicago. And are you a frat man? No. All right. Your guard is up. Your guard is up. This is old timers thinking. Your guard is up because either he didn't want to mess with him or else they didn't want him. So at least you want to find out the reason. See, ipso facto, it doesn't mean that he's no good. It just means there's a reason. And it saves you so much time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is very important with black people. See, because there's so much activity going on that you can waste your time. And this way... You don't have all that money where white folk can spend, sit down and spend a long time and select a friend. You hit a town and you got this enough money to last you overnight, you can sort out friendships very fast. And you establish.
Why do you think the fraternities you were saying were very important?
Yeah.
Were there other reasons too?
As far as I was concerned, the main reason was that you didn't have to get in and bump heads to make friendships. That was the main reason.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, if you went to a town, you were automatically invited to their parties. And you don't have to, and you, another thing, you see, you go to, like when I was living in Boston, I told you about this girl. I remember the girl's name was Catherine Avery, a pretty gray-eyed black girl. And she and I really hit it off. And I couldn't take her to any frat affair. And she wanted to go and have a good time. She wanted to enjoy and meet fellows from the other parts of the country and so forth. I couldn't do it. I couldn't take her. I'm not a frat man.
Right.
So, I made up my mind I was going to get in the alphas when I got back here, which I did. But it didn't matter too much before I left. Yeah. I bumped heads. But they say it isn't important anymore to say that frats don't count too much anymore. Well, I can't say on the way it is today because my son isn't a frat man.
But during your time...
Mm-hmm.
But during your time, it was very, very important.
To my time, it was very
socially
important. Very important. Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you if you had been involved in any churches.
Yes, and not in a fervent membership way, but one of my best friends was Reverend Clayton Russell, and Reverend Russell included me in nearly every one of his activities, and he and I could count on each other all through the years, and he died about, he had a funeral that rivaled Lauren Miller's, and I have the obituary upstairs, but that was Lauren, that was the only the Church of Divine Guidance. Since that time, I merely listen on radio or TV to Reverend Price over here at the church. I you know about that church.
Which, the First AME?
No, the Reverend Price's church is Faith, they call it the Faith Temple. It's got, have you seen the big drone over here at 78th Street?
Well, I'm not sure. Tell me about it.
Reverend Price comes on 11 o'clock every Sunday morning. He's in his 60s now. He's a young, fair, black fellow, very nice looking. His church bought the land, the acreage, where Pepperdine was. That they took all those buildings and they remodeled them, and they put a big dome. You see it from airplanes, white and blue. And they made the, they bought and paid for a $14 million piece of property. It's all paid for. And this is the most beautiful edifice you have seen in a long time. And it comes on at 11 o'clock. But I listen to him. He doesn't, it isn't a matter of where he is just shouting phrases. He teaches, and he's teaches you and interprets the Bible to you and makes you have a Bible there to read and to understand what is being said. And he doesn't deviate from the Bible in its interpretation, that he, you're not relying on what he is saying, that you, he quotes, he makes you read it, you know, one of those things.
Yeah. Okay.
But I should think that make it your business to see that church. And you can see it comes on channel 11 on Sunday morning at 8:30, and you can see the building, and it's gorgeous.
And did you ever go over to
that? No, I've been there, yes. I went in there. I couldn't go in the... He's got the other building, the remaining building they first started in. It's a beautiful building, too. But this drone is something to behold, and you can see it in the television setup.
You were saying earlier that your mother was very involved with church. Your mother was very involved in church when you were growing up.
She was involved to a degree for a while. She was more involved in YWCA work. Yeah.
What church was that when you were growing up?
It was the AME Zion, Pico and Paloma. That was a well-attended church. And my father and them used to go there, and they'd take me with them. But thereafter, on Sundays, they worked all week, and they didn't travel all the way downtown to go to church. Yeah.
Where was that one? Oh, Pico and Paloma.
Pico and Paloma, right. Los Angeles.
Okay. What would you say have been sort of the most significant events in the community, like socially, politically, historically, events that really stand out in your mind of things that happened?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think. I know there have been some elections. The most significant political event that seemed to me to be almost a miracle was the rapid rise of
Tom Bradley.
I saw him come up as he's been in my office at times, and I saw him when he was on the vice squad, and I've been to court with him in lots of cases. I would be on the other side. I noticed his, he just was a natural leader of those fellows. I thought he was very gracious. I knew he had been an excellent athlete. He was a fine sprinter, and I've always been interested in athletes. And then to see him go first to the city council and then work up to mayor of this city was to me just a stupendous event. And particularly when he didn't get all black support. I knew him intimately, and this was just a great thing. Then another thing, I knew David Williams as he's a Kappa, and I told you an Alpha, and we used to have rival outfits, and we had basketball games, one frat against the other, and he had me a pallbearer at his mother's funeral, and I got worried that he was going to be appointed municipal court judge. But when they appointed him, it foresaw that he was going to have to face an election in about a month, right after he was appointed. And so I got out and worked for him, and took up money for him, and David Williams, we call him Bill, was made a, he re-won the election, and later on, things happened. I saw him go to the Superior Court, and I saw him become a judge down in Santa Monica, and later appointed to judge of the district court here, United States District Court. And he is enjoys seniority down there now. Dave is 1 year younger than I am. So he's a senior judge. That, to me, was something great. Then I saw Ralph Bunche go up. And I saw Russell, Clayton Russell, become maybe the number one radio evangelist and fine public speaker. I saw him go right to the top. These are things that meant a lot to me. And standpoint of my cases, to see certain people walk into my office was a great thrill. Like, I became an intimate friend of John Levy, the boyfriend of Billie Holiday. And he would call me from other parts of the country. We clicked off, and we made it. And then I took her being rather ordinary. And then to see this great surge of publicity after she died, everybody was fighting to be known to her, and I had a wealth of material here where I knew her so well, and never did think she was as great as they are saying she is. So that's it. These are some of the events. I think another great influence in my life is when I met my first wife at Ohio State. No question that she and her family had a great deal.
Was that Bellinger?
Yeah. They great deal because they just kind of opened up the world to me, and I was so provincial from California and country, and they just let me see that what you could do. I saw too the benefit of money and how important money is. I've seen that old man walk in the bank, and this is the time when I told you houses, you could buy a house for $1,800. I saw him walk in the bank and the bankers say, "Mr. Bellinger, we're waiting for you. How do you want that money today?" And they say, "Well, we have $50,000 here in small bills and so forth." And here I am sitting up there just thinking $1,000 was a fortune. And this old man was walking in there getting bundles of cash and walking out. This kind of opened my eyes there about things. And from a social standpoint, I think that what gave me a real awareness of back east and what things were going on in the other part of the country was here I was a married guy, and here I ran into a woman who was a married woman, and we sacrificed everything, you know, for the consummation of this, especially when we both got divorces.
Oh, you mean you fell in love when you were married?
Hmm?
You mean you fell in love with someone else?
Yes.
Uh-huh, when you were married?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I was married to the mother of my children. See, I first married Bellinger in school. Then there was a real reason why we broke up, a legitimate reason. And a deep-seated reason, which, so then I married the mother of my children, who was Anne Franklin. And she was the daughter of the medical officer of Prairie View University. And the next one was, I'm out of my element, though, see. I'm still provincial, I'm still California, and I run into a showgirl from New York. So, of course, I get the chance to meet all these people, and we end up, break up our marriages, and marry.
That was Ethel?
Hmm?
Was that Cecil?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Then, after a period of time, I discovered some things, and it ended up I sued for divorce. And it was a 9-day hard trial. I went through 9 days of it, and I won. I won, and but in the meanwhile, I saw her. I saw her kind of disintegrate, and it ended up that I readjusted and had to start over again. I did, and I married my present wife, and we've been married over 35 years.
Wow.
So we talk about, so, and I got in her everything I've always wanted. A beautiful woman. She was a beautiful woman. She's up in 82 now. And she has a wonderful housekeeper. She's immaculate. She's a great mixer. She knows everyone out there in those stores on Beverly Hills, to my detriment. But just a fine person, entirely different in personality. I found out.
The other ones, were very short and close together, too. Is that...
That's right.
Yeah,
they were very short. Uh-huh. They were very short. 5-year deals,
uh-huh.
See.
Uh-huh.
Not frivolous reasons for breaking up. The reasons were deep-seated. And so it ended up that I saw Ethel go to pieces, and it almost was pitiful in the end, because her great beauty was just knocked out by bad living, and I remember her calling me before she died. She told me, she says, my cancer has, what do you call it? You know, where, what's the word you use when you, remission.
Oh.
She's gone. It's gone in remission. It's gone in remission. Thank God. Thank God. Pray for me, Walter. Thank God. And she's on her way to her death then. Yeah. So I've seen all these things happen. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you been involved with politics?
Yes, I, but lightly, just running for, I ran for Congress once.
Did you? Yeah. What seat was that? When was that?
Republican, in the year, I ran against Gus Hawkins.
What year was that?
That was, 1954, 1955, somewhere around in there. Yeah.
And so what was that experience like?
It was tough. Hawkins had a well-oiled political machine, and it was, he was Democratic, and the Democrats were nothing in my neighborhood over there. And so I tried to do something with the Republicans in that neighborhood. And I had a splinter group that was breaking off from the Democratic Party, and my chances were very slim. But I put up a good fight, got some votes, but couldn't overcome the machine at all. And my good friend, Beatrice Devon, she was one of the ringleaders in the Democratic Party supporting Gus. And so she, just like a lot of others, told me, Walter, no, we can't desert Gus. This is our man, Gus. And that's the way it was. So I faced it. Did the best I could.
Mm-hmm. Are you still Republican?
No. I am no longer Republican. I kind of fell out with Reagan and that bunch. So I'm not a very active Democrat either, but I favor the Democrats, and I favored Clinton. I thought, I'm not a Jackson man either, Jesse Jackson man. I don't like Jesse Jackson.
Why is that?
And I was just, we were talking yesterday, and I found out that nearly all the guys sitting around the table, about six of us all talking, all older guys, and we don't like Jesse Jackson's style. And hi.
Hi,
Mrs. Gordon.
We're back at it.
Yeah, I see.
Come in here. I want her to see you.
Oh,
come on here. I just got through telling her about you. Come here a minute. I just want to show her how she's 80.
She looks great.
I think she does wonderfully well. And she has all the things I looked in the others, you know.
Yeah.
Now, see, something else you want me to...
Oh, we were talking about Jesse Jackson.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I was telling you about these men. These are all black guys. They're all conservative, good thinking men. The kind of, I just want her.
Did you let her out? How are you today?
Good, how are
you? I just want her to see how good you're looking.
Oh my. I've been in the, well, first of all, we got down and Leo was late as usual.
Rusty.
But they're having this drive on the flu shots. Did you know that today?
Oh, I didn't know that today.
Oh, down at Kaiser Hospital.
So what are
they? It was the worst line I've ever been in.
So did you get a shot?
To get in the hospital.
The drive on what, honey?
The drive on the flu shots. They're giving everybody flu shots.
It's supposed to be a bad flu year this year.
Yes.
How do you hear?
Oh, it's awful. Kaiser was donating their services and couldn't get a place to park.
What is it, for people so they can be immune to something?
To the flu.
It's supposed to be an epidemic this year, isn't it?
Oh, is that so?
But they say they don't even know if flu shots are going to do any good, too. Did you hear that?
And I don't get the point.
Because it's like every year, you know, they have to, I'm going to put us on pause here for a minute. Back again. Okay.
I was telling you about these conservative men, and I mentioned it first, but I just didn't like the way they project themselves. And I thought the family was very pushy. And then I went on to describe this son that just graduated from law school. And I stopped there, and one of them took up, says, he pointed at me, he says, I agree with you. And this, apparently, there was one that took up for Jackson and said he had served his purpose. He had run for president. He gave a certain dignity to it. It wasn't regarded as a joke and so forth. But personality-wise, the group didn't go for him. And this was, I thought that I was alone, this didn't like, but apparently they all same way.
Were you involved in the civil rights movement?
I should say I could be described as I was lukewarm. And I feel guilty about it afterwards when I see the sacrifices that so many people made. But I, as a lawyer, I could have been described as being a civil rights because I took on a lot of those cases. But I mean, I'm talking about the active hardship that some of those people went through, those marches, and going down south and risking their lives. Those are the things that make me feel rather guilty, because I had no idea that those things weren't publicized out here. I had no idea that people went through so much. So I don't think that I have a right to say that I was a true civil rights worker, knowing what I know what they've done. I just got to have seen that TV KCET deal.
Eyes on the Prize.
Yes. So, of course, we all had shades of that when in the various cases we brought, but nothing like those people.
Can you think of some examples of the cases to you that stand out in your mind in that regard?
I have lots of cases where I didn't have too many, but they were going on all the time.
Thank you very much.
Would you like some water?
Oh, thanks, honey. About refusal to serve and discrimination. Don't forget, I came up during the time when I'd just grown used to refusal and used to denial. And I had professors in law school who said the law was you can do this and you can't do this. For instance, they taught about discrimination on railroad trains and so forth that was permissible under Plessy versus Ferguson. They went all into the principles of it. I knew it was an 8-1 decision. And here I am in law school, and the professor is teaching law, and he tells you, you got to go through the principles, what justifies it. On restricted covenants, the professor taught that this was legal, permissible.
This is when you're in law school.
Yeah. So, I'm young and just hoping to get a license and not being too sure I'm going to pass the bar. You know, you're under a great fear that you might be going to all this law school and not pass the bar. And I was just being thankful that I could get by. And I didn't think of upsetting the world or anything.
At that time.
You know? Yeah. And didn't think of upsetting a lot of these decisions. When the decisions come down changing things, they would be as much a surprise to me as they were other people.
What were some of the big changes in the decisions
that
you remember?
Well, the big change was the restrictive covenant. That was the big change. Then King and those marches and so forth broke down the voting situation and also discrimination in public places. Now, the discrimination in public places doctrine didn't affect us here in California as it did the people down in that section of the country. For instance, I've read excerpts from attorneys who were writing about their experiences in those years in the southern courtroom. I read where one attorney named Shores in Alabama was standing behind the barrier there in the courtroom up where the attorneys stand, and he was forced to go over and sit down in the segregated section among spectators, not allowed there. And that in another incident, when he was arguing to the jury, he was looking the jury in the eye as he was arguing the case and standing before them. And the judge told him, look, you come up over here and look me in the eye. Don't look that none of those jurors in the eyes and stand and argue your case to me. I didn't know such things were going on because I was getting along fairly well out here in California. I never dreamed that we were going through such hell.
So really, the California experience was a lot more sort of progressive or not as intense.
That's
in that
true.
I've heard people say, you know, California, we thought, you know, people who migrated, who said we thought California was, you know, the land of, you know, was a dream.
Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah. But California, the judges were nice. You never run through any of those types of experiences. The closest bad experience I had, it was one that gathered a lot of headlines. I have referred here several times to the fact that Joseph Scott was the Catholic lay leader, and I pointed out the photograph of Scott to you with a group of other people. But Joseph Scott had a son named Joe Scott. Joe Scott was a graduate of the University of Arizona law. And he came here to California, and he had some difficulty passing the bar, and his father helped him. And he got by the bar. But he was a kind of a big fellow up there. He got in the criminal court system, and he could crack good jokes, and he was, he knew he was very familiar with everyone. He didn't have too much dignity, but you could tell he could be mean when he wanted to be. But he was a California man, and some things that happened to me in the courtroom, you wouldn't expect from a man from California. But I went to court representing two black men who were accused of contributing or having a relationship with a white woman. And so I go to his court, and as I come down the hallway to the courtroom, I could hear a woman cursing and using all types of profanity, calling the bailiff SB, calling the district attorney a bunch of names, foul names. And the district attorney, whose name was Ritzy, who became a judge, came over to me and said, "Walter, we've got this woman in here." He says, "She's foul mouthed," and says she has created a disturbance, and I want to get her out of the courtroom as fast as possible. Although serious, more serious charges could be filed, she's still a juvenile. He says, "Take a plea to contributing to delinquency of a minor." He says, "Just a technical term, and I'll explain it to the judge." He says, "And so I can get this woman out of the courtroom because she's causing too much of a disturbance." I asked the guys, and they said, "Yeah, that's all right." So we went in and we took a plea to contribute to delinquency of a minor. They got her out of the courtroom in a hurry, and we come back for probation and sentence about 30 days later. And so Richie Chudy's word has made that recommendation that she was a tough character and so forth. And I remember the judge looking at both of them, and he looked at me, and he says, "Well, I'm going to put both of you men on summary probation." And he said, "You don't have to do any time in jail, and you'll be on probation for 16 or 18 months. And he says, "Good luck to you." And the men started walking toward the door, going out. And at that time, he kept on reading, and the courtroom was full of a lot of poor-looking, you can say almost trashy looking white people. I had never seen this before. They looked like an out of town caravan coming from somewhere. So they got to the door, and he says, "Hey, wait here, wait, come back here. This was a white girl." And when they came back, and I stood there, and he says, "Do you know what would happen to you men if this were down in Alabama where you come from?" And so I looked at him, and I said, "Well, Judge, aren't you indicating a bit of prejudice in your handling of this case?" He says, "What are you trying to do? You're trying to resurrect some idea of prejudice in this case, or discrimination?" I said, "Judge, you've already done that." And I said, "Well, doubtlessly there are a lot of people in this courtroom," because I'm referring to the kind of looking people they were. You know, just like white people can look at black people and they can kind of determine what type they are and so forth, black people can look at white people and find out and tell who they are, where they stand for something, and so forth. So I said, "Doubtlessly, there are a lot of people that kind of agree with the way you're talking from the way they react," I said. "I've noticed that." I said, "But I want you to relieve me from representing either one of these boys. of either one of these men, because I want to see you in chambers, and I'm going to tell you some things in chambers about yourself that will prejudice these men if I continue to represent them. He said, that's when he said, what are you trying to do? Indicate that I'm prejudiced or something. So he says, well, men, do you want to relieve your attorney? Because I want you to know I'm going to change the sentence. And if Mr. Gordon doesn't wish to go on and represent you, because he's going to tell me some things. And both of them, surprising me, they both said, no, we want to keep him. So he said, all right, I'm going to put this case over for 2 weeks, and I'm going to decide what to do on it. So I go on outside in the courtroom, and the guys go out. And this judge has a reporter who has been with him, a court reporter, a stenographic man, who's been with him for years. His name was Kenyard, K-E-N-N-A-R-D. And Kenyard sat there with his red carnation, who has never particularly paid too much attention to me, but we got along. I went outside the courtroom and started down the hallway, and Kenyard passed me, going very fast. But he didn't stop. He said, Mr. Gordon, he says, I want you to know you can rely upon me reporting this case exactly the way it happened. That gave me, I made me feel bad, because some of the little things. So I got back to my office, and the Daily Worker was on the phone. And then the various papers got on the phone. And they went at it like crazy. There's a bunch of fish gobbling up something. And I got my office, and reporters came down there in droves. And
what year was this?
This was, oh, that got me. But this was well publicized. So if anybody's got any energy, they could find this. It's well published. Uh-huh. So at any rate, Judge Scott called on me. His secretary called, saying, you quit putting those rumors out, what I was supposed to have said. He says, I'm going to bring a civil suit against you. He sent the word, that his secretary. And I know I did wrong, but I told him, I said, you tell Jed Scott that he is the kind of a man that I would just like to meet outside that courtroom, because I would like to beat his ass. That's what I told him. So the next, the papers all came out with it, and powerful old Joe Scott called me and wanted to know, what did my son do? He says, all over town up here. And I told him exactly what he did. So another judge, Judge Nye, who was heavy Catholic, called me in his courtroom and said, Mr. Gordon, I heard from other people what you're supposed to have done, and I want to know exactly what happened, because Joe Scott and I are very good friends, and I'm Catholic, as you know. I said, yes, and I told him what had happened. He says, we're all ordering a court reporter's transcript of what happened. And he said, we're not.